You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Toxic mold has become a hot topic in the news lately, and to help us understand what it is and what we can do about it, we've invited back to our show Monona Russell, industrial hygienist, founder and president of Arts, Crafts, and Theater Safety. Also with us by phone from Lubbock, Texas, is Dr. David C. Strauss, professor of microbiology and immunology at Texas Tech University. I'm very pleased to welcome them both to the show. Hello.
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 Monona, we've been hearing a lot about toxic mold recently. Why has this become such a hot-button issue?
Well, in the recent years, there's been a lot of cases lost. People who obviously have been injured by mold, and a lot of them didn't even make it to court. And we've now found out that it's due to some papers that were actually written as scientific papers, but they were written by people who do testimony in the defense in those cases. And so a lot of judges were even dropping these cases as not scientifically provable before they even got to court.
Well, let's talk to the scientist. Dr. Strauss, what exactly is mold?
Well, mold is an organism that essentially we couldn't survive without on this planet. Its main job is to break down cellulose, which is the most abundant organic material on the planet. So if mold did not exist, then everything that had ever been living would still be completely intact and the world would be completely unlivable.
Well, how many species of mold are there?
Well, we believe that there are probably 100,000, but there are probably many more than that that have not been identified as of yet.
And only a few of them are toxic?
Well, The truth of the matter is that toxic mold is really a misnomer. The correct way to say it would be mycotoxin-producing fungi. Probably most molds produce some type of mycotoxin, which, of course, is a fungal poison. Some of these mycotoxins are extremely toxic to humans and animals, and some are not. For example, penicillin, you know, which is a wonderful antibiotic, is really a mycotoxin. It's toxic to bacteria, but it's not toxic to human beings. So some mycotoxins are extremely toxic to us and some are not.
What about the ones that we find in cheeses like Brie, Stilton, and other cheeses?
Well, of course, those are not toxic to human beings.
Mm-hmm. But they are doing something that is equivalent to becomes toxic to humans only with milk or with lactose or whatever other thing they're working with?
Well, they produce products that we use to produce cheese and curd and whey and those types of things. But, of course, they're not toxic to human beings.
We often think of black mold as the bad kind. Are all black molds toxic?
Well, the truth of the matter is that essentially all molds growing on building materials appear black in color. The black mold has really been used to denote the genus Stachybotrys, and yes, indeed, most Stachybotrys species indeed do produce potent mycotoxins.
Now, what are mycotoxins? Are they mold spores?
No.
They are the things that are created by the interaction of the mold spores and the thing that they're on?
Well, mycotoxins, literally, myco means fungal, and you know, of course, what a toxin means. So mycotoxins are what we call secondary metabolites. That means that they are compounds that are produced by fungi but are not necessary for the growth and survival of the organism.
What kind of exposure to these molds causes illness? Do they have to be breathed in?
Well, primarily we believe that the two ways in which fungi cause what we refer to as sick building syndrome, that is, make people sick in buildings without infecting them, one is very well known and very well worked out, and that is the inhalation of high concentrations of fungal spores. We know that this causes respiratory disease like hypersensitivity, pneumonitis, allergic reactions, and even asthma can be triggered by the inhalation of fungal spores. The other way in which fungi cause disease in buildings is by the production of these mycotoxins. And what we have been able to show is that indeed when fungi grow in buildings, they produce these mycotoxins. These mycotoxins do indeed get into the air where they can be inhaled. they are indeed inhaled by human beings. What we don't know is are they inhaled in concentrations high enough to cause the diseases that we see? And that really is the last question in the puzzle.
So it's a matter of whether length of exposure is really important, whether a small amount of mold or a short exposure might be innocuous, but a higher concentration or longer exposure could be harmful?
Yeah, that's exactly the way it works. And indeed, not only is the time of exposure, the route of exposure important, but the type of organism that the person is exposed to is also important.
What types of health problems are caused by exposure to toxic mold? Are they mostly respiratory problems?
I won't say that they're mostly respiratory problems, because the respiratory route is the way that the organism gets into the body, or the way that the mycotoxin gets into the body. But once it's into the lungs, it becomes solubilized and goes essentially everywhere in the body and can cause mucosal bleeding. It can cause hair loss. Some of these mycotoxins can even cause death if they're inhaled or ingested in high enough concentrations.
And if I go to the doctor with one of these reactions, what is the doctor likely to say?
Well, it depends. Once again, we believe that the way in which mold causes health problems in buildings is one by inhalation of fungal spores, and those are essentially respiratory diseases like hypersensitivity pneumonitis, allergies, asthma, and what a doctor can do for you then, of course, is just recommend avoidance. Get the building fixed so that you're not inhaling these fungal spores anymore.
So asthma can be caused by or exacerbated by exposure to mold?
Oh, absolutely.
What about hay fever?
Hay fever, absolutely, yes. Hay fever, of course, is an allergic reaction and can be due to the inhalation of fungal spores.
Aren't some molds considered carcinogenic?
Well, the molds themselves are not carcinogenic. The mycotoxins that they produce are carcinogenic. For example, aflatoxins are known liver carcinogens produced by a species of Aspergillus. And another species of Aspergillus called versicolor produces a compound called stearicmatocystin, which is also a liver carcinogen.
My guests are Dr. David C. Strauss, professor of microbiology and immunology at Texas Tech University, and Manona Russell, who is an industrial hygienist and founder and president of Arts, Crafts, and Theater Safety. And this is WNYC and WNYC.org. In many cases, I throw this out to both of you, one person in a home or workplace will become very ill while others remain relatively unaffected. Why would that be? Are some people more sensitive to mold than others?
I'd be happy to answer that question. One possibility would, of course, be that that person that you're talking about is allergic to that particular type of organism, and the other people in the house are not.
So we can be allergic to a relatively benign mold, at least benign for most people?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, mold allergies, of course, are well known. And also the time that an individual spends in the building may also be important. You know, a person can spend a long period of time in the building as opposed to someone who spends a shorter period of time.
And then there are people who have compromised immune systems. Are they more susceptible to mold?
Well, of course. People who are immunocompromised are greatly at risk for fungal lung infections, because we are inhaling fungal spores every minute that we're alive. Whether we're in a building or outside of a building, we're always inhaling fungal spores.
There are people who claim to have developed multiple chemical sensitivities from mold exposure, including a woman named Angela Page, who's a school librarian in Liberty, New York, recently profiled in New York Teacher magazine. Are schools especially prone to mold, Manona?
Oh, yes. There's real maintenance problems in a lot of school districts, and we see water leaks and spills and things that aren't fixed. And you can go into many schools and see stained tiles and complaints from the teachers, and, you know, the smell sometimes is even clear that there's a mold problem.
Dr. Strauss, why is multiple chemical sensitivities a controversial issue? Or is it all that controversial in the medical community?
I have to admit, that's not an area of my expertise, so I would defer to your other guests. I'm an expert in microbiology, but multiple chemical sensitivities I really don't know much about.
Well, can you see a scientific basis for the connection between mold exposure and chemical sensitivity?
Well, I really don't want to speak to that because I just don't know the literature on multiple chemical sensitivity, so I really would not be a good person to ask.
Yeah, it's very difficult, and
You've been following the story?
Well, I've been following a lot of it because I also pick up the phone and answer questions and have for 30 years, and so I've talked to an awful lot of people in addition to looking at the research. And, of course, multiple chemical sensitivity as a diagnosis is the kiss of death in terms of any kind of lawsuit or recovery because there really is no test to prove that you have this disease. And so I think that there are some people that really do have a problem where they become very sensitive to many chemicals. But as for an entity that you can clearly say, aha, there it is, and here's the test that confirms it, no, it doesn't exist.
Well, why are we seeing so much mold growth in buildings now? If we are, it just seems that we're having it reported more. Is it because building materials have changed, drywall and particle board replacing hardwoods and plaster?
Yeah, there are two primary reasons. One began with the energy crisis in the 1970s when pretty much any building you go into now today, you can't open a window. And that, of course, was done in order to control energy costs. So buildings are really closed structures now. So any type of contaminant that gets into a building really has no way to get out. The other reason, of course, is that we build buildings essentially now out of paper. Sheetrock, drywall, ceiling tile, pretty much anything you see in buildings today is made out of cellulose, which, of course, is the primary source of mold food. So those are the two primary reasons.
I would take exception to the first one because, when they first started with these systems of closed building, they didn't bring in enough fresh air, didn't take out enough fresh air.
They relied on air conditioning systems,
That's
usually
right.
closed air conditioning systems.
A lot
systems.
Of recirculated air instead and so on. But if you really design a building properly so that the right amount of air is coming in and going out, the controlled air systems actually provide a better climate than just opening a window. Since I design and work with architects on many buildings, of course, I'm very sensitive to this issue. And we very often get people who want to be able to open the windows in their buildings. And since I'm in the art field in particular, that can destroy the whole system that you've developed in order to keep people safe in that building.
Well, whenever we get a lot of calls for the gurus of how to, who are regulars on the show, about mold in bathrooms, and their answer is open the window or keep the door open if you don't have a window, or you should try to have a vent in your bathroom.
Yeah, there's those 300 CFM powder room fans will do a lot of good.
Should we also be worried about mold anytime there's a link in a roof or a water pipe or flooding from a rainstorm?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The minute these cellulose building materials that he's talking about get wet, they really need to be thrown out. Once they've started growing mold, they're done.
I imagine that was a major problem in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina.
Oh, that was awful. They sent people there. They sent children, young people, to help clean up these houses without protection, without understanding the risks that they were taking. I read many accounts of people saying that their hair was covered with it, their clothes were covered with it, that everything stunk. That's no place for young people and people who don't know how to handle their protective equipment.
Do we know if there have been any reports of illness caused by mold in New Orleans?
Oh, yeah, there are many. In fact, they have something called Katrina cough, which
That's
is
right.
very common in the city.
Which would be parallel to World Trade Center cough, which is when you have things that are in the air that, you know, we were designed to breathe air. You put things other than air in the air, and there's going to be some people having a problem.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we also invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-9692. WNYC. My guests are Manona Russell, who's an industrial hygienist and the founder and president of Arts, Crafts, and Theater Safety. Also with us is Dr. David C. Strauss, professor of microbiology and immunology at Texas Tech University. We're talking about molds with Dr. David C. Strauss, professor of microbiology and immunology at Texas Tech University, and Manona Russell, and I should spell your name, MonoNaRossol. She is an industrial hygienist and founder and president of Arts, Crafts, and Theater Safety. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. How would we know if our homes or schools or our workplaces are affected by mold? Is it usually visible, or can it be hidden inside the walls? And if it's hidden, how can we find it?
Well, the primary way that we know, or I won't say the primary, but one of the most important ways that you know that you have a mold infestation problem is just by the smell.
It smells moldy?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
That's right.
A dusty, dank smell, kind of like wet tennis shoes on a summer day. That's what mold smells like.
And since, Monona, you said that we're not meant to breathe in these things, even if this is not the worst kind of mold, it still is something that we don't want to be breathing in?
Yeah. Mold can cause just plain respiratory irritation at high enough levels. And it's not only the spores you have to worry about, but you can think of these as little plants without chlorophyll. And when they dry, also they break up. There's little pieces. That's why when we use respirators to protect ourselves, we like to see them use the best quality, the HEPA-filtered type respirators, because there's not only these larger spore things that are floating around, but there will be little tiny bits of plant-like material that comes in. Those can cause people irritation. Some people will be allergic to some of those, and they seem to be able to also reduce immune function, some of the mycotoxins that are produced. And the smell that they produce is a mishmash of chemicals. Really, they've done some headspace studies of mold growth, and they've actually found solvents like methylene chloride and benzene and things, as well as some of these complex hydrocarbons.
You mean they create benzene?
Oh, yeah. Some of them, they metabolize. Little plants are like little chemical factories, and each one has their own mix that they make.
So these are just like regular plants that are taking things out of the air and the soil and changing them into something else.
That's right.
But they're not making oxygen. Once a building has developed a mold problem, what can be done? Are there fungicides that can be used to kill it?
Well, no, that's not the way that should be handled at all. There are two things that should be done, and only these two things work. And the first, of course, mold only grows in a building due to water intrusion. So the first and most important thing to do is find out why the water is getting where it shouldn't be and fix that. Because if you don't fix that, everything else you do is a waste of time. The second thing, then, is to find the mold growth and replace it with the new building material. Those are the two things that have to be done.
Well, I had a fire once, and mold became part of the problem afterward. And the fire department just simply said ammonia and dish detergent, mild dish detergent, just wash the moldy areas. And it seemed to work.
Well, it depends, of course, once again, on how much mold you had.
Maybe it was just a high-quality ammonia.
Well, ammonia will certainly, and bleach will certainly kill organisms. But if you don't correct the water intrusion problem, mm-hmm. then it will grow right back.
Or if it gets deep enough into the building material, then there's really nothing else to do but to cut it out and replace it.
Let's take some calls. Our number, again, 212-433-9692. And we go to Dr. Adrian Sprouse. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm Dr. Adrian Sprouse. I'm a physician here in Manhattan, and I've been involved in both diagnosing and treating patients for chemical sensitivity and for mold exposure for more than 15 years.
And
I really appreciate the other guests and you're covering this topic. The last guest who talked about the different chemicals that molds give off, I think, is really the source, more of the heart of the problem, even more than mold spores, because chemicals do give off acetone, hexane, benzene, and a lot of hydrocarbons in their normal metabolism. And if you look in any textbook of toxicology, what you'll find is that these volatile organic compounds are nerve damagers. So what we see in our patients here is not only respiratory disease like asthma or more advanced lung disease, but we see a lot of neurological problems like sensory problems, cognitive dysfunction after mold exposure.
Let me break in right there and say that the mycotoxins produced by Stachybotrys, they're called trichothecenes, which are protein synthesis inhibitors,
right,
cause exactly what you're speaking about, neurological damage and cognitive dysfunction.
Sure.
Now, have you testified in court?
Yes, I've been documented as an expert witness for mold and for other environmental problems.
And how do the courts receive your testimony?
I've never lost a case. What I do in preparation for the testimony is really prepare an A to B to C to D pathway for the judge to understand what is happening. You know, mold exposure is not something that's well understood in the courts. And to look at more of the allergy literature, you would think that only the mold spores serve as upper respiratory irritants. But it is these gases that I believe are the more serious problem. And once I pulled the research papers that have measured these gases by gas chromatography and categorized them and then show from a toxicology book exactly what these gases can do from whatever source, but these gases are from molds, then the judges understand.
Thank you so much for your call. Actually, many of the decisions that have been against people who say that there has been some health problem from mold are based on a position paper from the American College of Occupational and Environmental Medicine that says, in part, scientific evidence does not support the proposition that human health has been adversely affected by inhaled mycotoxins in the home, school, and office environment. And the paper was prepared by three doctors, Brian Harden, Bruce Kelman, and Andrew Saxon, who have often appeared as expert witnesses for the defense in mold cases.
That's right. And that paper was cited by a lot of the court cases.
And why would the courts believe that rather than what Dr. Adrian Sprouse says or some other expert?
The journal that it was published in, the credentials of the doctors that wrote it, and the fact that they did not disclose that they had a bias when they wrote this.
So would you disagree, Dr. Strauss, with that finding that scientific evidence does not support the proposition that human health has been adversely affected by inhaled mycotoxins?
Well, once again, I'll go back to what I said previously. We know that these are extremely poisonous compounds that get into the air, are inhaled, and definitely get into the body. What we don't know is, are these mycotoxins inhaled in concentrations sufficient to cause human disease? Now, we know that if enough of it were inhaled, indeed, they would make people sick. But once again, we don't know that the inhalation of mycotoxins actually causes human disease inside of these houses, because what happens is you don't see people dying in these buildings, but what you do see is you see people getting quite sick. And so, you know, the obvious conclusion is this is a highly poisonous compound that's in the air and people are inhaling it, and it's something that should be avoided. Is it actually causing all of the pathology that we see in these people? I would say that we don't know the answer to that yet.
We have to separate the things that are toxic from the things that can produce classic allergy, because that we can prove, and that we can see and even stimulate and quantify. If it's causing an allergy, there's no question but what those symptoms can be, anything from a little scratchy sore throat to pneumonitis. I mean, it's just, there's a whole range of things that can go wrong, and those should be easily defensible.
My guests are Manona Russell and Dr. David C. Strauss. We're talking about mold and toxic mold, and this is WNYC, WNYC.org, also available as a podcast and on the satellite. And we go now to Bert from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I used to be a mycologist, and I'm referring to molds in rooms inside and indoor surfaces. My first question is, how useful are mold-resistant paints and insulation that one puts on pipes?
Who is that question directed to?
Either of you. It doesn't really matter. Both of you can answer it.
Do they really do the job?
Well, it depends, once again, on the material, the paint that you're talking about. They can be an inhibitory for mold growth.
They sure can, and especially the studies that I've been most interested in because of my field are the insides of ducts, because that's where your ventilation is. And they found that the best surface not all these fancy paints, but the best surface is a galvanized metal surface because there's a lot of zinc there, and the molds don't like that zinc at all, and they really don't grow on it.
You see green mold there. Is that...
That may be green corrosion rather than the mold.
So the mold can actually have an effect on the thing that it is obviously eating and create another kind of a color other than black.
Oh, yeah.
Let's take another call. Bob from Queens, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I do a lot of mold testing in people's homes, and one of the fallacies that I find is the smell, the odor, and I wanted to comment on what one of your guests said earlier. What I find is that the odor is given off primarily when the mold is growing, and the mold only grows when it's wet. When it dries up, when the water source goes away, I find that a lot of times, in many situations, it doesn't smell at all. And, of course, the mold spores don't smell at all. So it's a little difficult to tell people that if you know you can use the smell to find the mold. In my work, I find that to be of very little use.
Are there ways of detecting mold? Are there detection kits?
Well, and what he said is exactly correct. The molds only give off these VOCs when they're wet and when they're growing. Other ways in which you can detect mold, for example, you can detect mold spores in the air by essentially pulling them out of the air and depositing them on petri dishes, and they'll grow. So that's a way in which you can detect mold spores in the air because, of course, you can't see them.
Well, the other way that we use quite commonly is we pull them out of the air and we stick them onto a microscope slide. It's known as a spore trap. And by putting that microscope slide under the microscope, we can see what types of spores are there and how many are there. And because we know how much air we sampled, we can actually quantify the amount of different types of spores in different areas. And by comparing clean areas, areas that may have been affected by water, outdoor versus indoor, we can pretty easily diagnose where the problem is coming from and whether the airborne levels are acceptable.
Yeah, that's a perfectly acceptable way of doing that.
Yeah, the only trouble we have in court there is there's no really good standards for how much is too much.
Now, Dr. Strauss, you're going to be happy to hear this. I'm not going to read it all, but we got an email from a listener who says, my wife and I went through a hellish experience due to massive amounts of hidden mold inside of the walls of our building, and after a total hell, we were lucky enough to discover Dr. Strauss and his group and their work at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. A lab did testing, and they discovered that we had serious Stachybotrys problem, but they were not able to test for toxins. Dr. Strauss's group were... They tested samples from our building for trichothecene, I guess that's right,
yes.
Mycotoxins, and the samples turned out to be very toxic. And the situation improves because of what you did. Are you called upon by people all over the country to do that sort of thing?
Yes.
And does that mean that you're pretty much the only ones who are doing it? This person is from New York and went to Texas Tech.
That's interesting, but actually we don't do that anymore because my lab ran out of money.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
And I wish we offered that service because we were the only people in the country that could do that. Now we can't.
This other person writes, sometimes I smell mold coming from my air conditioner in the summer. Is this something I have to be concerned about?
I would think so, yeah.
Now, why would mold be in the air conditioner? Because rainwater has collected there?
You know, an air conditioner is really a pretty simple piece of equipment. You know, you can take them apart and take the filter out and take a look around and wipe it down. There's a lot of things you can do to an air conditioner and just get rid of this stuff.
Are newer paints doing a better job? Or are the new latex acrylic paints doing a better job than the old ones?
They do have biocides in them, but they used to have some biocides that were pretty effective but are now banned. They had mercury biocides and all kinds of things. So it's a question now whether any of these are really very effective. As I said, the most I've looked at is the various kinds of paints and coatings on ductwork. And, boy, you know, the plain old zinc worked so much better than any of the paints.
Before we go, is Christy Whitman's testimony yesterday relevant to this conversation?
Yes, it is because of the Deutsches building. That's where they also had huge amounts of mold. That's one of the major reasons they're taking it down. It had been cracked open by the fall of the towers, and water just damaged that building terribly.
She said that one of the major problems was that they told everybody to wear masks, and many of them just didn't wear them.
Right. That just did not happen. And they're all saying, well, we couldn't make them, or we couldn't. They don't understand. The laws and the regulations say it's not up to the worker. It has to be up to who's in charge of the worker to enforce the rules and the regulations. And they weren't enforced by anybody because neither, well, I don't know how political you want to get, but nobody had the interest of the workers. They wanted to get things open and running down there.
And Dr. Strauss, you suggested earlier, I think it was you, that the quality of the mask is important?
Well, actually, that wasn't me. That was your other guest. But but I would certainly agree with what she said. But I would like to give this warning, is that mycotoxins have a molecular weight of around 500, and they will go right through a mask. So those masks won't protect you against mycotoxins.
Yeah, even if you have a double type of mask, even if you have a filter that is mechanical, which you'll get the little bits and pieces and the spores, the gases and vapors that are created by that smell will only be captured by organic vapor cartridges, and even they won't catch all of it. So there is nothing that is really 100% effective against mold.
And we do not want to walk around our apartments and our houses wearing masks all the time, even if those masks are effective. It really makes kissing very difficult. My thanks to both of you so much for being with us. Monona Russell, who is an industrial hygienist, founder and president of Arts, Crafts, and Theater Safety, which deals with issues of this sort, and Dr. David C. Strauss, professor of microbiology and immunology at Texas Tech University, and I'm sorry to say, no longer funded enough to do the kinds of tests that we are learning today are so important to maintaining our health. Thank you both so much for being with us. It's been really interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you.